It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard around the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host Mark Young. And here's a quote from Google today.
Yes, Jebediah.
We all got screwed in 2016, so we're going to make sure that we set our algorithms so this doesn't happen again in 2020. It's a loose interpretation, but that's basically what they said.
So
I am not a tech guy, so what exactly does that mean? How do you do that?
Well, there are a lot of things that can happen here. So here's what people don't understand is when you look at Google, you're looking at this big brother. It's literally referred to as big brother.
It is now.
And it's an algorithm. And what can happen in this stuff, Chuck, is everyone uses Google. And Google's almost like a public utility today.
You know, it is. It's true. Hardly anybody. I mean, I know there are alternatives, but very few people use them or choose
Google
them.
Has the majority of all the search traffic.
Around the world, correct?
For most of the world. Yeah. In China, they use something called Baidu. I think that's the big one there. But at any rate, it's like a public utility. Mm-hmm. So instead of going to the phone book and saying, I need to find a plumber, you go to Google and you type in plumber Texas and you find a plumber.
Right.
Well, Google controls what the results are. So let's say that you go and you type in border crisis. Mm-hmm. Okay, because you want to find out, all right, I want to know who's telling me the truth about this border crisis.
Okay.
Google can control which results you'll see. So all of a sudden, they would have the ability to...
Oh, so this is kind of like you buy shoes at some place, they come on and say, you might like this.
Well, that is an algorithm, but...
Say, I like, let me think of somebody, Dave Rubin, just pick it out of the air, Dave Rubin. And then they come up and say, well, you might like CNN and MSNBC.
True enough.
Okay.
But even more, think about it as curating what you get to see.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you go to Google and you want to find out the truth about climate change.
Right.
So you say, I want to get to the bottom of this. So you start typing in truth about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Google can decide what is the truth about climate change. You typed in the terms truth about climate change. Their algorithm.
So it's their perspective.
Correct. Their algorithm can be programmed to deliver what they want you to believe is the truth about climate change.
Well,
that's
so
big power.
The 2020 election, what are they going to do about that? What's the truth about Trump? I mean, we all pretty much know.
Well, give you an example with, let's say, Facebook's algorithm. What most people don't realize is when you're on Facebook, you're seeing a curated experience.
Yeah, explain that. Well, I don't understand what you mean, curated experience.
What the algorithm does for Facebook is the algorithm decides, well, Chuck Woolery's a conservative.
Right.
So he likes Fox News. He clicks, you know, he likes these stories that come out of Breitbart.
The Guardian.
Right. So we're going to curate the data that makes it into his Facebook page to fit what he likes.
I check everybody. I watch CNN. I watch MSNBC. I go to their sites. I go to Breitbart. I go to a lot of different sites. I go to Drudge, I mean, which is just basic news. It depends
absolutely
on what it's like, that's all it is.
And that will come into play,
yeah.
But ultimately, these algorithms are so sophisticated that they will determine even though he looks at MSNBC and he looks at CNN and he goes over, you know, to Huffington Post, he's really right wing.
Never go to Huffington Post. Huffington Post is not one of my destinations, I have to admit.
But Huffington Post goes to you, though.
Yeah, well.
So, folks, I got to tell you this, because you can't see this right now. Chuck has this Jebediah Woolery look going on. It's very Abraham Lincoln-ish. I kind of like
it. Is that what it is, really?
Yes.
He didn't have a mustache. He just shaved it off and left it.
Correct. Abraham Lincoln did not have a mustache. He only had the beard.
Kristen hates this. She just hates it. She said, I will not be seen out with you. It's the only time she's ever said that before.
No, I can see the problem.
It makes you look sinister.
No, I think it makes it look like you're about to raise a barn.
Well, so, there's that.
So you need a white shirt and a pair of suspenders because you're way too fashionable to be your typical run-of-the-mill Amish guy.
Yeah, it's coming off tomorrow, so
whatever. So, Chuck, I got a little story here before we get going here I want to discuss with you.
Okay.
And this is an obscure story, but it is so indicative of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, the Democratic Party, the left, is supposed to be the party that's inclusive. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to be the party that welcomes everyone, right?
Well, not really, but okay.
But no, that's the story.
I'll go along, yeah. Okay.
Play along, Jebediah. Okay. So Psychology Today just ran a story. It was written by Karen L. Blair and Rhea Ashley Hoskins, and these are academics from universities. Okay, wake up, Jebediah.
Just lost me there for a second.
They have now said that if you, Chuck Woolery, or you, Jebediah Woolery, if you were to say that you would only date a woman who was born as a woman, not a woman who used to be a man and became a woman. Mm-hmm. That you are a bigot.
I'm not dating Chris or Bruce Jenner right now. I've known him for a long time. I'm not dating him. Okay.
And it is true that your current wife can bench press an Audi, but
it's true. She could.
But she was born as a woman.
She was, yes.
She has all the original equipment that you would expect.
Yes, she does.
So the whole thing here is now that cisgender individuals who refuse to date transgender people are dehumanizing transgender people.
Where is all this crap coming from? I mean, it's so bizarre. It's, I mean, I look, I'm 78, okay? I grew up in another realm, another world. I'll admit to that. But I've kept pretty current throughout my life and tried to be, you know, up to date on things. But this is like crazy. It's just insane what's going on with this 78 new genders. And I mean, well, what's happening?
The researchers were quite shocked when they found out that 87.5% of straight people say they want to actually date other straight people.
Yeah.
They're surprised by this.
Is this one of the tail wags the dog thing where they just pick up a giant minority and blow it up into what they think is a majority, which is happening all the time with almost everything?
Well, here's the thing, by the way, people who did say that they did not want to date transgender people made comments like transgender people are make-believing their identity is something else. They said, and this is horrible, some of these people said they wanted to marry people or date people who potentially could have children with them.
Well, whoever thought of that, I wonder.
I have no idea where this comes from. And here's my whole point is, I'm willing to accept the notion that sexual preferences are something that we can be born with. So if we look at, you know, I like chocolate and you like vanilla and you like country music and I like rock music, people have all these different tastes. And I get that. No two people have the same taste. You like different movies. So I don't think it's unreasonable that people would have different sexual desires or different sexual preferences. And that's, you know, maybe somebody likes BDSM. Somebody wants to be gay. Somebody has a foot fetish, whatever. What I don't understand is if your particular thing is that you're a straight male and your preference is straight females, why does that make you a bigot and make you a homophobe?
Well, everything contrary to what the left feels today, and I say the left in generally speaking, not everyone on the left, but you know, a lot of people on the left who drive these things. If you're not for it, then you are a bigot. That's their response.
I mean, but it doesn't make sense to me because
I've been called, you know this, I mean, on Twitter, I'm called a bigot and a racist and everything else. I've never been either one of those or homophobe or xenophobe. I am an Islamophobe, but I will admit to that. But I'm not.
The Jebediah thing is making me rethink you not being a bigot. I got to tell you, it's disturbing to look
These
at.
People out there can't see me. I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's, but I do look it's very disturbing, much people. It is disturbing.
I know.
So here's my point. Mm-hmm. I'm okay if somebody says, I have friends who are gay and they prefer other men. Cool. That's your choice. Why? I don't think they're a bigot because they like other men. Then why am I a bigot because I like women? Well, this makes no sense.
The whole thing is you can't be an individual anymore and make choices. You have to follow the group. And if anyone is, everybody's looking for a safe space today and everything else. We see this happening in our society. And so people are very easily led and saying, well, I can't do that because it doesn't matter what I feel or what I think. I have to think like the group. So it's a group thing, trying to.
It is group thing.
Lump them in a singular group and push it forward and make it normal. I personally think it's abnormal, but that's my opinion. I'm certainly should have that opinion, or at least have the opportunity to have my own opinion. So, and I don't, here's the bottom line with me, and I don't know how about other people feel about it. I don't really care. I mean, I really don't. I just
clearly you don't care what people think, because I'm looking at you right now.
I'm having a hard time living this down. She was holy cow. That's when you don't take advice from someone who loves you.
I know. Well, Jebediah, we are going to spend the rest of the show today, and we're going to talk about gerrymandering. And I'm really interested in getting into this because I actually have – the Supreme Court is on the edge of coming out with a decision on this week. I don't even know if they've even come out with it today. Mm-hmm. But we have a guest with us today who is David Daly.
He's an expert on gerrymandering.
He is an expert on gerrymandering. So we'll learn more about him. He is the author of the national best-selling book. Can I pronounce this best-selling book?
Well, he's so smart, he wrote something you can't pronounce.
Well, no, it looks like it has an obscenity in the middle of it. So it's Rada F, why your vote doesn't count. And his journalism has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and a slew of other publications you refuse to read.
I've been found out.
All right, David, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you, buddy. So thanks, you're an expert on gerrymandering. Well, to begin with, I don't want to condescend to our audience, but right now. Explain what gerrymandering is. What exactly is it, and why is everybody always so upset about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Gerrymandering is sort of the dark art of politicians in power drawing district lines that entrench themselves in power and hurt the other side.
So in other words, all Democrats pick out Democrat places, and all Republicans pick out Republican places, so they keep getting elected over and over again.
Exactly.
They draw lines around them.
But there's essentially two main ways of doing this. There's packing, and there's cracking. So essentially, if you have got the pen, then you're trying to ensure that your side gets more seats than anybody else. You either want to pack the other side into as few districts as possible, that they win with a huge majority, or you crack them and you spread them and dilute them across a whole bunch of districts.
Mm-hmm. So who allows this? Has this always been going on from the beginning of time? Is it a new phenomena? Is it what?
Afraid so. I mean, as long as we've had politicians, they have tried to draw district lines that give themselves an advantage, right?
And who allows them to do that?
Themselves.
Themselves, exactly.
Once you're in power, once you're a congressman and you're in power, because this has to do mostly with Congress, right, or the House, correct?
It's got to do with the House of Representatives, but also all of our state legislatures across the country.
Yeah, this is very much a state thing, Chuck.
Oh, okay. All right. So once they get into power, they start drawing lines at that point. Obviously, you can't do it without power, right? Once they become elected. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
I think an interesting question that most people probably won't understand, but we'll clarify it as we go along. So we have all of these illegal aliens coming into the country by the thousands. And they're guessing now that it's up around in the 20 million category, not because it was like 11 million for 17 years. It's like nobody ever came in. So it's, they figure it's around, you know, somewhere in 22, 23 million people, maybe. Nobody really knows. And now we have a census coming out. And Trump, as a matter of fact, I think has this on the census. He wants people who are only citizens to be part of the census. Because if you are packing a particular place like, well, Texas is red, so you start packing all of those counties as, or all those districts as blue with illegal aliens and saying, well, we have this much population here, so we can do what we want. You know, they're all going to vote Democrat.
Well, he's not saying that he won't count them in the census. What he is arguing in front of the Supreme Court this week is that there'll be a question on the census that will ask you if you're a U.S. citizen.
Right.
So they'll still measure they're in the country,
yes,
but identify whether they are citizens or not.
But since they are part of the population of a particular area, they are worked into the gerrymandering.
Well, let me start at the base here. We have, when we look at these districts,
did I just totally massacre that question?
Yeah, that's why I'm going to try to clear it up a little bit. When we're looking at these districts, we divide these districts out by the number of congresspeople that we have. So we take the total population, we divide that by 435, and that becomes the population that each district has. Am I on track so far, David?
You are exactly on track, yes.
So now we have, and I think the number right now is what, 455,000 per district? Isn't that the current number?
I think it's, well, it depends on the size of the state. But essentially what you do is you determine the 435 districts in that way, but there's, you know, certainly a 436 and a 437 that don't make it. And
right.
Based on the population changes over the course of the previous decade, you reapportion the House of Representatives every 10 years, which also, of course, affects electoral college votes.
Now, you can grow in
the number of congressmen as well, correct?
State can grow, but not the country.
A state can grow, and a state can also lose.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a state can get more congressional seats if it has a bigger percentage of the U.S. population.
Well, that's what I meant.
Right. But we can't get more congressmen. Just, we could get to reshuffle the deck.
Yeah.
But I'll give you an example. We have a district here in Michigan where, and people can't see what I'm saying, but you guys can. So here's a box right here. And then on the top of the box is literally a street, a single street that runs 5 miles north
and then goes 5 mile.
And then goes to another box. Because we have a population here, a population 6 miles up the road, and that's called one district. So they joined it by literally one road. When in reality, it should have been a box and let it go, you know, let the votes, you know, come what may. But it's carved up, in this particular case, it's carved up to benefit the Democrats, because here's a Democratic voting group, another Democratic voting group, but a Republican voting group in the middle. So they literally carve them out of the district so that a Democrat can never lose the seat. And it's happening on the Republican side too, I'm sure, David.
Oh, this is happening across the country. Republicans did a better job of gerrymandering after 2010, and they benefit
from a lot
of it right now.
That's absolutely Republicans do a better job is just an oxymoron.
I was excited. They, he just said Republicans that. Said, like,
yeah.
About time they did something right.
Now, that was a really brilliant strategy. After
brilliant Republican brilliant, I can't believe it. Okay, go ahead.
After 2008, it's a big Democratic year. Barack Obama becomes president. Democrats take the supermajority of the U.S. Senate. What a bunch of Republican strategists did is they said, well, we might have gotten our butts kicked in 2008, but 2010 has the ability to be a really big historic year for us because it's a midterm year, but it's also a census year. All of the districts are going to be redrawn after 2011. So they come up with a plan called REDMAP. It stands for the Redistricting Majority Project. And what it was about was winning state legislative chambers across the country, especially in blue and purple states like Michigan, like Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Florida. And by having every seat at the table in 2010, Republicans took control of all of those state legislative chambers, and they dominated a redistricting in all of those states as a result, and drew themselves maps that have advantaged them both in the states and also in Congress for this entire decade.
Well, you see, the Republicans have to do stuff like that because they don't have the mainstream media behind them.
So what's in front of the Supreme Court this week?
You've got two cases.
Explain them, please.
Both of them are really interesting because one of them comes out of North Carolina, where Republicans gerrymandered the state congressional map in such a way that they get 10 of the 13 seats, even though it's pretty much a 50-50 state. And then there's a case out of Maryland in which Democrats gerrymandered Maryland's 6th congressional district, and they turned this district completely inside out in order to knock out a Republican incumbent who'd been there for 20 years. And so, I mean, Maryland has a Republican governor who's one of the most popular governors in the country, but 7 of the 8 congressional seats, 88% of them, go to the Democrats because of the way Democrats drew the lines there. So essentially both states, you've had the party in power entrench themselves in power for the entire decade, regardless of what people want.
Now, the Supreme Court obviously hears cases based on the Constitution. So what is the claim? What is the unconstitutional event that is taking place in these two cases?
They're calling this a First Amendment violation of your freedom of association. Essentially, this is a case of viewpoint, a discrimination. If the state knows how you feel about politics, if the state knows how you are likely to vote, and they draw lines accordingly that dilute your power, you are essentially being punished for your political opinion.
Let me stop you right there. If the state knows how you're going to vote, I mean, do they? I mean, they couldn't figure out how Trump ever got elected. I mean,
at the beginning of the show, you guys were talking about how these algorithms are so sophisticated. And that's really what this is about. This is about big technology. So when they draw these district lines, they're doing so with this amazingly sophisticated computer mapping programs that they're able to upload all kinds of information to. You start with all the detail in the census. And then there's all these kinds of public record databases you can add up in there. What party are you registered with? What years did you vote in? What kind of car do you drive? Do you have a gun license? There's all kinds of private data things you can buy and upload in there. Magazine subscriptions, web searches. So these map makers who are drawing these lines can go up and down the block. They can take the block level precinct voting results from earlier years and have a sense of what the party registration is up and down.
This is scary, isn't it?
We are so polarized these days that we pretty much vote the same. If you tell me 5 or 6 things about you, I can probably give you a pretty good sense of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And these map makers can go up and down the street and just draw exactly the lines that they want. And there's never a mistake.
You know, the only reason I'm registered as a Republican, the only reason, is because I can vote in the primaries. If I were independent, I couldn't.
They would pick up your monthly subscription to Amish Monthly. they would know that you have that. Chuck, let me give you an example of these algorithms, and David's probably familiar with this, but I want to share this to you and the audience. So you're familiar with, let's say you want to get a credit card or you buy a car and they run one of the 3 credit reports, and the credit reports look at your history and they look at how well you pay your bills and so on and so forth. Okay? Everybody's familiar with that. There are new algorithms out now that examine your Facebook and your Twitter behavior along with your email behavior, and they can predict your credit worthiness and how likely you are to pay your bills more accurately from how you use social media than from your actual credit score. That's how sophisticated these are. Mm-hmm. So literally, and being in the advertising business, we do these type of things. We can build databases. I would give you an example. We have databases here in our offices that if we look at a product, So let's say somebody said, here's this hair care product. We can look at that product and we can tell you whether it's purchased by liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats. We can literally tell you the political leaning of the people who buy any product in a retail store. Because now we know what language to use to sell the product.
And the folks who are drawing these district lines have access to that precise information, and they're able to draw these districts in such a way that give their side a huge advantage for a decade to come, and it makes competitive elections.
And this gets down to, and Chuck, this gets down to what we refer to block by block data.
Block by block, census blocks, yes.
Yes, so when we're talking about a block, we're literally talking about a neighborhood, a city block. Here's this block of houses, and these 24 houses on this block are 72% Republican or 68% Democrat.
So when a district line runs up one street and not the other street, or when it runs up a one side of the street and not the other side, or when it, you know, splits a backyard, there's always a reason. I mean, a lot of the times, you know, we think of gerrymandering as being funny looking districts, and we kind of imagine them as being like, you know, weird shapes or something. Every single one of those funny looking lines has got a specific purpose, and the map maker knows why they're there.
So what's your ideal world, David? What do you think should happen?
I think we have to get the politicians out of the business of choosing their own voters. I mean, I think we want to have genuinely competitive elections, right?
And,
I mean,
and how do you, how would you do that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of ways you can do it. I mean, first, if politicians are going to be drawing these districts, there ought to be specific rules that they have to follow with regard to transparency, with checking their work, with explaining, you know, why lines go one way and not the other way. But I mean, I think that these lines could be completely taken out of their hands entirely. There are states that use, independent commissions of citizens, and, you know, those aren't perfect, and they can be gamed as well.
Sure.
But at least, it takes it a step away from the politicians, and at least it moves it someplace else. I think we could do something that is, you know, closer to what other democracies around the world do, and, you know, move towards a system that is, you know, less single district winner take all and more proportional, that opens things up to, you know, third parties and, you know, folk and independents of all different stripes. There are lots of ways we could do this. The problem is we're doing it the very worst way we possibly could, by allowing the people who have the biggest amount of self-interest in this process to have all the power.
But we've done it in everything. They get to choose their pay increases. They get to exclude themselves from being on health care. They get to decide, you know, what their retirement's going to be. What other job in America do you get to, you know, do you get the job and then you get to pick what you're going to be paid and how everything works?
And then you get to draw lines that entrench yourself in power, so that even if the voters don't like what you're doing, tough, you know, it doesn't matter, because they can't beat you. And then you add a campaign finance system on top of that, sets you up to that you have to raise millions and millions of dollars to even have a chance to win anything these days. And it is a rigged system top to bottom.
What's the Supreme Court being asked to decide this week?
The lower courts in North Carolina and Maryland have thrown out those maps and called them unconstitutional, and they have ordered that new maps be drawn.
Have they ordered how to draw the new maps, or just this isn't going to work?
They have said this is not going to work. So essentially it would go back to the legislature under some sense of court-ordered rules. They would have to do a better job and, you know, not allow for the kinds of partisan taint and bias that infected the old maps to show up this time.
Well, again, I'm going to ask, because historically, Democrats have controlled the House and the Senate. Historically, that's true. Would you agree?
I would, yes.
Okay. It has been really unusual. I guess when Newt Gingrich came in, we took over the Congress for the first time in 40-some years.
Yeah.
Took over the House. So this seems to be something that was really working better for the Democrats than it was for the Republicans. Would you agree on that because of history?
I would agree a little bit. I mean, I think that the real problem here came about when the technology and the voter data became so precise and so specific that you could essentially override the will of the people with these lines. Democrats certainly had a big advantage in the U.S. House for, 40 years, but that was a different time in some ways. I mean, it was kind of Southern white conservatives in the Democratic Party. I mean, I wouldn't say it was kind of a progressive Democratic Party that kind of had control.
Liberal. See, I think you have to be very careful because this goes back to when Hillary Clinton first ran for the presidency and someone said, well, now you're a liberal. And for the first time in my life, I heard the word. Sure. She said, well, no, I'm more of a progressive. And I thought, what the hell is that? Well,
I guess I would say this.
Back and looked up progressive and basically it's status socialism. I mean, that's really what it is.
Yeah. I guess I would say that from the 1930s...
It's Hegelism.
From the mid-1930s until about 1957, 58, while Democrats had control of Congress, it was essentially a coalition of Republicans and conservative Democrats that exerted most of the power. Mm-hmm. And that, Southern Democrats from...
The Blue Dog Democrats.
Yeah, and, Blue Dog Democrats essentially were the key in Congress, even throughout the 60s, 70s.
There are no more Blue Dog Democrats.
They don't exist. Well, they were gerrymandered out of power, essentially. And all of those seats went from becoming conservative Democrats to becoming conservative Republicans. It's a really interesting story. I mean, in the 1980s and early 1990s, what Republicans realized was that the way that the Voting Rights Act had been reauthorized under Ronald Reagan, it encouraged the creation of majority-minority seats. And a bunch of, again, a really smart Republican strategist recognized that if they drew black seats across the South, it would allow them to legally pack all of those Democratic voters into a handful of seats, and it would turn all of the surrounding seats more Republican and conservative. So in the 1990s, you get Newt Gingrich in 94, and you begin to see, North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, all of these states that had been dominated by Southern Democrats are now dominated by Southern Republicans, and the South goes solid red.
Hmm. So I have a question for you. First off, are you familiar with something I think is called Godel's Dilemma, which this seems to be an example of, which is a system cannot be repaired from within the system?
Yeah.
So how can you fix this system when they're going to remand this back to the people who are doing the bad deed in the first place and say, we'll do less bad deed?
Well, in Pennsylvania last time around, in Pennsylvania, in January of 2018, the state Supreme Court threw out the map that Republicans drew as unconstitutional partisan gerrymander, and they sent it back to the legislature. And what the court said is, we're going to have some people check your work. And so the legislature drew a map, and they handed it over to people who drew some computer simulations, and they created a program that created every possible universe of maps. They took... they drew tens of thousands of them, and they said, actually, the map that you came up with here is just as infected as the other one, so we're going to take the power to do this away from you. We gave you one chance, you still screwed it up, so we're taking the power away from you, and we're giving it to someone who they call the special master, and the special master drew a map, and the court said, we're going to use this one. And it elected 9 Democrats and 9 Republicans in the last election, about probably what it should have. So you can give legislators and politicians a chance, and if they screw it up, I take the toys and go home.
I think it's funny you said if they screw it up.
When they screw it up.
So here's my question. Why not just pass a rule that says every voter district has to be made up of 4 lines? So follow with me here. If everything was within a single box where you could only have four straight lines to make up your district, and by the way, a border, so in my thought, a border wouldn't have to be a straight line. So something that's, you know, a water's edge, a state border, it wouldn't have to be straight because it's a natural boundary. But if every one of these districts had to be a single contiguous box, wouldn't that end a lot of this?
It makes a lot of common sense, and a state like Iowa is able to do that really, really well. And in Iowa, they essentially have state bureaucrats who just kind of draw a bunch of squares, and it works perfectly. The trouble is that these districts have to be identical in population in order to be fair to everybody. And if you just draw square boxes, the population doesn't live in square boxes. You know, states aren't all as square as Iowa or Wyoming. So it makes it tricky to draw lines that, you know, fit all of the people in, but are still fair. But I think you're onto something. You know, I mean, whenever these districts take on bizarre shapes, you usually have a sense that, you know, some kind of mischief is
right. To me, it seems like it would make sense that everything fits in a box. Yes, there will be some exceptions, but then I think there should be a process to determine the exception.
I think that's right. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a contiguity and compactness are two of the key criteria when it comes to drawing districts. And when you get away from contiguity and compactness, you are generally letting partisans in to, you know, run wild.
Yeah, it seems to me the problem falls apart when we start trying to make these districts that are not contiguous. To me, that's where it gets the problem.
I think that's a huge problem, that contiguity, that compactness, kind of, you know, holding together communities of interest, all of these things are what you want to do when drawing lines. You don't want to be drawing lines that, you know, give the party in power an advantage for the next decade, especially not with the kind of technological tools and algorithms that they have these days to draw themselves, you know, decade-long permanent advantages that nullify the will of the people and the consent of the governed.
Well, just for a second here, we're going to ask Jebediah Woolery to take us to a quick break for Blue Emu, and then we're going to come right back to it.
Blue Emu works fast and you won't stink. This episode of Blunt Force Truth is brought to you by Blue Emu Pain Relief Products. Now, I've been in show business for many years now, and I'm not slowing down, but I can use a little help every now and then. Blue Emu's family of products are made in America and have become a staple in my life. The deep penetrating formula of Blue Emu Original is best for supporting my muscles and joints, and I'm sure you've seen it. It's on the shelf in a blue and white jar. I also use Maximum Arthritis for any arthritic pain and the Lidocaine Cream for numbing pain relief. Not only do these Blue Emu formulas work great, there's no chill, no burn, and no odor. Blue Emu, it works fast and you won't stink. Available at Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Amazon, and other fine retailers.
So we're back. Chuck, go ahead. You can lead us off.
Well, I was going to ask you a question. You mentioned this more than once about our democracy and things like that, using that word especially. What do you think about the Electoral College and just a democracy vote across the country where the numbers count instead of in the Electoral College? Do you think it should be done away with, or do you think it's an old idea or unfair or what?
I like the idea of a national popular vote. You know, I mean, I just think that we've got
so this, a democracy.
Yeah, you know, I think straight up, that the leader of the country ought to be elected by, you know, popular vote. I mean, I think that right now we've set up a system in which about 7 or 8 states seem to matter and get all the attention. And perhaps if we had, you know, an actual popular vote, you would see candidates campaigning
in 7 or 8 cities.
Well, you know, but they'd show up in Texas again. They'd show up in California again. They'd show up where people live. But I think that there are lots of good arguments on both sides. but it does seem like we're coming to sort of a crisis point in the idea of representative government, and that if a representative government doesn't have the consent of the governed, it's, you know, it's hard
So in other words, we're going to do away with the republic and become a democracy.
Well, I'm not sure that there's that much difference between the
Sure there is. Yeah. I mean, the difference is states are democracies and the federal government is a republic, which I think is very confusing to people because they try to conflate the two when they are totally different.
I think what we have is a representative democracy, and that what we want is for it to actually be both representative and democratic. And we've got a lot of structures, you know, including gerrymandering, you know, sometimes the electoral college that kind
of stands. Have you read anywhere in history how democracies usually turn out? I mean, just this is a legitimate question to you.
No, yeah.
You obviously are a very smart guy. So, I mean, you really, when Madison said democracies eat themselves and then they kill each other off.
He said it's the most vile form of government known to man.
So,
and Franklin talks about a republic.
If you can, democracy around the world, when in fact we're a constitutional republic.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as Franklin said, I give you a republic if you can keep it, exactly. Right?
Right.
And
so there's this constant struggle all the time not to keep it, to change it, and to become
something exactly
else.
Right. That's exactly right. But how do you keep a republic or a representative, a democracy, when the structures of elections kind of get in the way of a majority will?
Well, David, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Let's say that we got rid of the Electoral College.
Sure.
Okay. Now, what your point is that, so I think your point is Republicans don't campaign in California and New York for the presidency.
And Democrats don't. Well, I don't think anybody does exactly. I mean, those states are.
Right. So there's no sense in Donald Trump spending a lot of time campaigning in California because he's not going to win California.
Nope. But there's also no point in Hillary Clinton showing up in California or New York either. You know, both of them show up and they, you know, take cash out and then go spend it on ads in, you know, North Carolina and Florida and Ohio.
So they're going to go campaign where there's battlegrounds.
Yes.
Now, if we got rid of the Electoral College, as a candidate for president, am I not now going to just gravitate to the largest population pools?
Why is that bad if that's where most of the people in the country are? I mean,
it's not where all of them are, and they need to have a voice as well.
But everybody gets one voice. Everybody gets one vote.
But remember that when we built the country, the purpose behind the Electoral College and the purpose behind the way that we divide Senate seats is to balance power between lesser populated states and more populated states.
Thank you, Benjamin Franklin.
Yes. So, well, I think the
you're point welcome. Stop calling me Benjamin Franklin. but my point is, if we did away with the Electoral College, then every presidency from here on out would be determined by New York, Los Angeles, you know, New York, California, Texas, Illinois. Texas, Illinois, California, and New York would pick every president.
I'm not sure that's exactly the case number-wise. I mean, Texas is very large. I mean, Florida is very large. I mean, there's.
But California has what? 12% of the entire population.
Republicans still win in large popular elections. Republicans win. You know, the two most popular Republican governors in the country are in Maryland and Massachusetts. I mean, I think the idea that Republicans can't win in some of these places is wrong. I think that they've simply stopped showing up in a lot of them because so much of the country is so obviously blue and obviously red that we've forgotten how to talk to one another and there can't be any more debates. I think if you have a position where, you know, Democrats can't just write off California and neither can Republicans. Democrats and Republicans can't write off Texas. Then maybe everybody shows up, maybe everybody talks, and perhaps there's a conversation and a debate again that, like, actually allows the country to kind of come together and function. I don't think it can hold.
So when you find the address of this utopia, would you please send it to me?
Yeah, let's work on it together. Yeah.
I do get the thinking behind it.
Yeah.
I get the thinking, you know, popular vote makes sense. But I'll tell you what.
Well, it's always, it goes back to the eyes have it. You know, it's a majority rules. And our founding fathers in their wisdom really didn't find this to be a good idea because when they set up the Electoral College, it included everyone. Everybody.
Well, they knew the biggest states would always win.
Exactly.
But what do you guys think about the National Popular Vote Compact, this compact in which states that
15 states that have signed on to it right now.
Do a little bit of both, right? I mean, so it would hold the Electoral College together, but you would have states pledging to back the winner of the popular vote. I mean, it almost seems like that does a little bit of both.
It defeats the purpose of the Electoral College, I think. And I think once you have a genuine understanding of what the founding fathers were trying to do with the Electoral College or what they did, excuse me, anything that defeats that purpose, I think, is contrary to what our Constitution was and our country was built around.
I wonder what they'd think if they looked at where people live right now.
God, they would.
I mean, it's interesting.
Their graves today, are
you? Right?
It's
over so many things. Yes.
Oh my God.
See, I'll tell you what concerns me. What I see when I see people wanting to get rid of the Electoral College, what I see is a form of a repeat of the 17th Amendment. And when we look at the 17th Amendment, which for people listening was an amendment that we passed, I think it was back in 1913.
That's Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson era. And the idea was that we took senators and we made senators popular vote, just like we're talking about with the president. So prior to this time, what happened with senators, folks, was that every state had two senators, and those senators were usually what were considered elder statesmen, which, by the way, an elder statesman in 1776 was 35 years old.
Right.
So these were elder statesmen that were selected by the state legislature, and they went to
the state.
Right, and they went to Washington to do the bidding of the state. Mm-hmm. And so think of them as ambassadors. And if the state didn't feel that their elder statesman, that their senator was representing them correctly, they would recall him and they could replace him. The legislature could say, you're not doing what we're asking, and this is what we want. So the founding fathers made it very clear that if the Senate became a popular vote model, that senators would cease being loyal to their state, and they would become loyal to Washington. They would become loyal to parties. They would become loyal to the federal government. And we have clearly seen that. When we look at senators today.
You know, David, it's really, let me interrupt you just a second. It seems to me like senators today are nothing more than a vote. That's basically it.
But they're national politicians now.
They're just a vote.
They are certainly national politicians. And I mean, the trick here, though, and just to kind of bring it back over to gerrymandering, is if you've got a state legislature that has been rigged in a way to produce someone from one side or the other, and then if those people are the ones who are choosing a U.S. senator, it just magnifies all of this kind of unrepresentativeness in the system.
Well, gerrymandering wouldn't affect a Senate race like it does congressional seats.
Well, it would without a 17th Amendment. I mean, if you had a state legislature that was, picking elder statesmen and sending them to Washington.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I mean, certainly right now, gerrymandering does not affect the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate has, its own issues and problems, some of which you've, just identified. Gerrymandering right now certainly is a bigger problem in the U.S. House and state legislature.
Well, now, is gerrymandering from a party position, if the Democrats win, it's not a bad idea, and then if the Republicans win, it's a really bad idea, or vice versa?
Yeah, it's an awful idea, no matter which side wins. I think that the Democratic gerrymander in Maryland is just as bad as the Republican gerrymander in North Carolina. That we have got to have elections that matter, elections that are meaningful, that are actual debates. I mean, as so many of these state legislatures around the country have been so gerrymandered that 75 or 80% of the seats in states like Georgia and Wisconsin and elsewhere don't even have any major party competition. There's nobody even running there. Citizens in those states have no choice at all.
They're not competitive.
And there's no reason for them to be. Like, I mean, there isn't a single Democrat or Republican in some of those districts who says, I'm going to spend the next year of my life running in this seat. And so that just, you know, makes things worse.
And this is how we get lifetime members of the House.
And it's how we get lifetime members of the House who are completely insulated from the people and can go off and do whatever it is they want.
So what do you think would happen if we could end the gerrymandering? And we'll talk about how you think we should do that, whether it's my idea of doing contiguous boxes. Your idea, I believe, is to take it out of the hands of politicians. Is that correct?
Yes.
So if one of these two or both of these two things happened, what do you think Congress would look like in the next election?
I think you would see a dramatic change in the number of incumbents. I think that there are incumbents who stay in these seats forever because they're safe there and they've been drawn for them. And that if the districts were changed and not drawn to benefit them, that they would get out of office and they would not want to go out and do the work of introducing themselves to new people. I think you would see more competitive races around the country. I mean, I think you could see more, I mean, what you've seen as districts have become more and more gerrymandered over the last 20 and 30 years is that you've got more extreme Democrats and more extreme Republicans, all of them from perfectly safe seats, and that nobody in Congress knows how to talk to one another anymore, that there's no more liberal Republicans, there's no more conservative Democrats, there's no more bridge builders in the middle who can, you know, translate the lingo of both sides and maybe get something done and kind of find some worthwhile compromise. And I think you would see more of those kinds of people back in office. Perhaps we'd be able to, you know, make a system work again.
I mean, I'm looking right now, Chuck, I don't know if you can see this. I'm going to hold this up. This is the congressional map of Michigan. Do you see one box in there any place?
No, it looks like the map of the states.
Look how ridiculous it is.
But what you ought to do
states
is,
were formed.
Yeah. I mean, take a look at Michigan's 14th, which is hard to see on that box because it's small. It's in Detroit. And I went out and drove every turn of that district when I wrote the book. It took me 14 hours of going turn by turn from some of the poorest neighborhoods in Detroit.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It's
like a snake. It's absolutely insane. I mean, there are points where you can hit a golf ball across it. And the entire purpose of these districts, you know, I mean, the purpose of that district is to draw a seat that Brenda Lawrence, a black Democrat, wins with like 75-80% of the vote every 2 years.
John Conyers was in the same spot.
And then it also makes the neighboring districts around Detroit a little bit more Republican by packing all of those Democrats into those districts there. But, you know, there's a reason behind all of these lines, and it never works to help us. It always works to help them.
I mean, it is absolutely insane the way this is cut. So if I'm understanding you, you're not so much saying that if we clean this up, we'd have less Democrats, we'd have more Republicans. It sounds like where your real focus is, we'd have less incumbency.
I think we'd have less incumbents, and I think that that our politicians would be incentivized to act differently. In so many of these elections, in so many of these districts, the only election that matters is the party primary. So you end up with a race kind of all the way to the extreme, and then the winner of the party primary in a district that's all the way Democrat or all the way Republican, especially in this era of polarization, is essentially a shoe-in to win. And those party primaries, you know, they happen in July and August when most people are on vacation. You know, it's about, you know, it's 7 or 8% turnout. These are not the people who ought to be able to coax all the way in. We ought to have the general elections matter more than these low turnout primaries. We would get a different kind of politician who would then act a different way.
And he's absolutely right, Chuck. There's so many of these races that the primary is the only race that matters.
Right.
So you have three Democrats running. The Democrat who takes the primary will automatically win the general election. And the same thing happens in Republican areas.
And it's always the furthest left Democrat who's going to win a race like that.
And I am for anything that will reduce incumbency.
Yeah, we had a whole march toward term limits on Congress and term limits. You know, it's never going to happen. I mean, it came within a vote when Gingrich was House leader, but that's the point. It came within a vote. I mean, they're not going to vote themselves out of office. I mean,
but maybe this is something we can do, though. So David, how do we do this? What can our listeners do to make this happen?
You know, I mean, I think it starts with knowing about it and talking about it, right? I mean, there is a reason why these guys entrench themselves, and it's because politicians know that gerrymandering sounds boring. It sounds wonky and technical and nerdy, and it's about maps and stuff like that. It put us to sleep in high school if we were lucky enough to even have a civics class. So we have to understand that there's these invisible rules that help keep these guys in office. And the more we know and the more we talk about it, it stops them from getting away with it. We need to have more transparency and openness in this entire process and to kind of stand up and demand it. Because if we don't demand that these maps, which are in so many ways the building blocks of democracy, and when they get twisted by partisans, it twists the nature of our elections, of our representations, of our politics. So we've got to get involved and be aware that these elections matter. And we have to show up and turn out every single time. There are a lot of elections this year that will determine the next decade in a lot of these states. So if you live in Louisiana, if you live in Virginia, Kentucky, the people who are elected this year to state legislatures will be in power for the redistricting in 2021. So, you know, ask them what they think. Get out and vote in these elections, because you are not just electing someone for the next 2 years. You're electing in all these states right now someone who's going to draw the maps that controls what your state politics look like until 2031. That's a long, long time.
I'm looking at the California congressional district map right now, and there is barely a single district that has a straight line. It is so butchered up. It is so gerrymandered up. Folks, I'm going to encourage you to go to Google. Yes, I know it's Google, but go to Google and type in the name of your state and the words congressional map, and take a look at the map of your own state. And if you've never done this, you will probably look at it and say, what the hell is this mess? Because it makes no sense when you look at it geographically. These are not natural boundaries. These are not natural places where populations end. There is nothing that makes any sense about these lines other than using data to draw areas where certain parties will always win. David, great having you with us.
Thanks, David.
Do you have a website or anything that you're using to explain this more to people?
You know, I don't. I'm on Twitter at Dave Daly and the number 3. And you can find Rat Effed on Amazon or any place that, sells books.
All right. We will have links to the book and links to your Twitter account in the show notes. So folks, just go to bluntforcetruth.com. Look for the episode with David Daly, and you'll find the links to his Twitter account and to his books. And I hope you'll keep us updated on anything that comes new our way on this.
Absolutely, anytime. Really a pleasure to be with you both. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And folks, I hope you enjoyed today's show. If you did, leave us a good review, as always. And we'll see you next time on Blunt Force Truth.